This podcast is brought to you compliments of Kaspersky Lab, protecting more than 300 million systems worldwide against internet threats.
All right, welcome to the Digital Underground podcast. My guest today is my old friend Joe Grand, the famous hardware hacker and security researcher who hasn't been doing a ton of security stuff in the last few years, but was back at Black Hat this year doing a presentation on some hardware stuff that he came up with that I will let Joe explain, called the JTAGulator.
Yeah. I just wanted you to say that name. I was waiting for you to say that.
It's a pretty great name. I mean, I feel like that's the key to a good Black Hat talk, is having some sort of fancy name for it.
That's right. All security researchers need to be good marketing people now.
Yeah. Oh, clearly. Yeah, absolutely. You've got to build your brand.
That's right.
So, Joe, your day job with Grand Idea Studios, you do all kinds of sort of fabrication and hardware stuff. Give me an idea of what kind of projects you're working on these days.
Yeah, sure. So you're right. So Grand Idea Studio, mostly I focus on developing prototypes of products. So things I kind of specialize in really simple, effective types of designs that do a single function very well. Like, I like technology, but I don't like the overuse of technology. So a lot of things I'll do are sort of adding technology to existing types of devices just to make them better, to help somebody a little bit easier. So I do a lot of household device prototypes and some consumer electronics, kind of sporting related devices for specific sporting industries are things I like. I like a lot of kind of battery powered, portable, low power, low cost types of devices. And of course I do a bunch of hobbyist designs as well. So essentially creating modules that people can use as building blocks to build up their own products or to build their own prototypes. So things like a text-to-speech device is something I've done. A bunch of RFID readers that are available in, Radio Shack and Fry's and things like that. And basically, okay. With the products I'll do from a design point of view, I try to license those out to companies. Since I'm just one guy and I love engineering, I love design, but I don't like the rest of the process, the support side, the production. Like, there's people that are better at that than me. So I figure if I can get that out, get the products out, get the prototypes out to people that know what they're doing, they can handle that kind of front-facing stuff, and I can stay in my lab and work on the next thing.
Gotcha. Okay. And so you mentioned prototyping. A few years ago, you had a TV show called Prototype This, which occasionally will still pop up on reruns. And, I remember a couple of weeks ago, I was flipping through and I saw you. I think it was the one with the fire robot.
That's right. That was probably the firefighter pack or something, or the stair climbing firefighter.
The stair climbing robot. That's what it was. Yeah.
Yeah. And that show, that was a fun show, because that was sort of introducing mainstream world, really, about engineering and about the engineering process. We just built, ridiculously stupid and crazy inventions. And it was a short-lived show, 13 episodes, and it aired on Discovery Channel in the U.S. just one. I don't even know if they did, repeats. It was just one episode per week for a few weeks, and then it was done. But now it's on Netflix, so everybody can get it on Netflix. It's airing all over the world and other places. Discovery U.S. is separate from, the other networks around the world, other Discovery stations and other networks that might be showing the show. So it's still airing elsewhere around the world. And then, of course, Pirate Bay and your favorite internet places to obtain television shows, it's up there. So I'd highly recommend everybody watches it. And, no, I don't get royalties or anything like that. My whole thing at this point is just get it out there, get people interested in engineering. And it makes it fun, because it's not, how do you explain to somebody, how do you show them soldering and make it exciting, right? You sort of can't, other than me. Like, I like watching people solder, but that's, I don't think most people do. and so it's like, how do you explain, how do you show this stuff to your kids or to your parents or to your grandparents and make it accessible? And that was the challenge of the show. And that also was the most fun, because we could just be really goofy and try to simplify these really complicated terms, like explaining how an electronic system works or something, or multi-threaded programming, right? It's like, how do you explain that and not be completely boring? So that was a challenge, but it was fun.
Yeah. And it was like, they would give you guys a project and you had 24 hours
So the original concept of the show was sort of to try to make it like American Chopper or some of those, build type of shows where they have these deadlines put in the show to add, I don't know, to make it more exciting or something. So they were like, okay, well, we have to build a new prototype every 2 weeks, which includes, that's from concept to final things, to the finale.
Right.
And it, which was really hard, because we had to not only come up with the idea, we had to engineer it, design it, test it, get it ready for the finale. And the finale usually was like a big thing in public or with lots of people around or something. And then, of course, we had to do all this stuff while being filmed and then being interrupted. So it's sort of like, imagine yourself, you know, writing code or something that requires lots of concentration, right? Like reverse engineering a binary or something. And every like 20 minutes, somebody interrupts you and interviews you about what you're doing. Like, that's sort of how the show was. So you lose your train of thought where you're trying to do engineering and then you're trying to do filming. It was really, really hard, but the outcome ended up being pretty cool. Like, it turned out to be all right, given how hard it was to explain to the producers and to the television network what engineering was all about. It turned out to be pretty good. But yeah, it was a sort of a fake deadline of this 2 weeks. Though we had to, they just chose that arbitrarily, but we actually had to meet that because that's how they scheduled the film crew and the filming and everything. So mostly 2 weeks. We had a few that were 5 weeks, like our 30-foot giant computer-controlled water slide simulator, which was like a giant donut of water slide material with big giant hydraulic motor and all the stuff to move it around. And that was a 5-week build, because I think the first three, or after the first week of mechanical engineering, the next 3 weeks were like 50 of the best Bay Area artists and welders and everything, just building this ridiculously huge structure.
Oh my God.
What's most frustrating about TV is there's usually a lot of people behind the scenes helping out and working on things that you never really see, right? And they never get the credit for it. So we were really upset about that, because you see all these people working, but you don't really know that, you know, they're putting in way more hours than any of us were as hosts trying to get this thing right just so we could go ride it. So I felt a little bit bad, but it was, all in all, it was a really good experience.
Yeah, from the show, you sort of get the impression it's like you and the three other guys just like working around the clock to build this stuff. And it's like, there's no way.
Yeah.
It's completely impossible.
Sometimes we actually did pull all-nighters by ourselves to get the stuff done. But for big things, there's no way. I mean, we had lots of, like, for anything big that you saw, we had mechanical engineers, you know, fully vetting the design, failure analysis. We had lots of partners that would, you know, give us free stuff for the show. So like carbon fiber legs for the six-legged all-terrain vehicle, and just all of these things that, you know, sometimes you see their little name in the credit or something like that, and that's it. But yeah, it definitely was more than the four of us working on stuff for the most part.
Right. Okay. So from all that sort of hardware background, you obviously used to do a lot of hardware hacking and still do a lot of that kind of stuff. So where did the idea for the JTAGulator and this Black Hat talk come from?
Okay, so yeah, so you were right at the intro. You said I haven't really done a lot of security lately, and that's true. I kind of go in cycles. I think like every few years I'll come up with some security related something to do. And last time I spoke at Black Hat was about defeating the smart parking meters in San Francisco.
Some work
I did with Jake Applebaum and Chris Tarnowski to basically just blow that implementation out of the water. And so it had been a few years. Like, I still teach my hardware hacking training classes at Black Hat and at other conferences and for private companies or whoever wants it. But I don't normally just pick a product and try to break it anymore. I get off more of teaching other people how to do it, which is why the class is really cool. But through teaching that class, I realized, like, one section of my presentation is about what do you do once you encounter a bunch of things on a circuit board. So whether they're test points or some sort of connector that you don't know what it is, or something you might think there's some sort of on-chip debug interface, like a JTAG interface on there, but how do you find it? And my slide was always a very manual process. It's like, okay, well, you have to remove the part and find out where the pins connect to somewhere else on the board, or you try to trace back the test points to the individual part. If you can get the data sheet, assuming you can even get the data sheet, assuming you even know the part number of the part. So it's a very manual reverse engineering process. And as I kept giving this talk, I'm like, well, wait a second. There has to be a better way to try to identify these interfaces. And that's where JTAGulator came up. It was basically creating a tool that will let people that don't necessarily have the time or the skill to fully reverse engineer a board to figure out what certain test points are, to just make it easier for them to find on-chip debug interfaces. So right now the support is for JTAG and for UART, for just serial connections. Because at that point, once they kind of get through that first step, once you have access to that interface, a lot of times the game is over and you can completely control a device. So it really, you know, it started as how can I come up with a cool idea that will make it easier for people, and now it just ends up, it turns out that it's just a very useful tool for, even for people that know what they're doing, it's a huge time saver for this type of device.
So what kind of devices is this useful for? Is there a pretty wide range?
Yeah, so pretty much I wanted to start with JTAG, which is a joint test access group. There's a standard, it's an IEEE 1149.1, which sort of defines this low-level on-chip debug interface, which really gives you control at a low level of every individual pin on a device. There's other features that we can take advantage of when we're using the JTAGulator, like a device ID that you can get out of there. Some chips support some slightly higher level debug functionality. You can extract memory. You can write to memory. And you can, since you can control every pin on the device, now you can talk to other things that are connected to the device, like external flash or, say, maybe a crypto chip or something. So it really is this Achilles heel kind of interface. It exists on very, very many devices. JTAG is one of those things, and that's why I chose it first, because it is this industry standard. Pretty much any, you know, I guess I would say like mid-range to higher microcontrollers will support JTAG. And if it's not JTAG, it might be their own, the vendor's their proprietary interface. Like Microchip has their own and TI has their own and everything. But JTAG still is this one that kind of is cross-vendor a lot of times. And so you'll see it and, you know, name a device, it will be in there, you know, whether it's mobile phones or ECUs in automobiles, medical devices, ATMs. You know, pretty much anything that has a microcontroller or a microprocessor these days will have an on-chip debug interface and very likely have a JTAG interface.
So the would this have helped out Charlie and Chris with their car hacking stuff?
Yeah, a little bit. So it turns out the few devices that they had actually, the few ECUs they had actually looked at, they had actually sent to me to extract the firmware for. And for those, it turns out, those are Freescale automotive microcontrollers, which use their own, instead of JTAG, they use something called BDM, which is a background debug mode, a Freescale type of on-chip debug interface. And it just so happened that on one of the designs that Charlie sent me, there was an unpopulated header for that BDM interface. So I could just use my off-the-shelf development tools, a P&E Microsystems multi-link device, plug that directly, you know, solder a connector onto the board, plug this thing directly on interface to my computer, run the free version of the Code Warrior development tools for this particular microcontroller, run the debugger, and just extract memory. Like, it was that easy. There was no protection. So that would be a case, since there was the unpopulated header there, and I knew it was a Freescale part, you wouldn't need the JTAGulator because you knew that for that, you know, for that part, Freescale has a BDM interface. For another one that Charlie sent me, there was no interface on the board, but there were still the connections on the chip. So I had to just run wires out to make my own interface. And then on Chris's board was a little bit different. It was an NEC Renesas part that didn't support JTAG. It had some other interface. So on those particular ones, they didn't have JTAG, but plenty of them do. I mean, that is just the way, you know, the way things are. And there are some protection mechanisms that some chip vendors try to implement as far as password protection on these interfaces and stuff. So that would be something, if you do discover the interface, sometimes you might need to figure out a way to bypass password protection or other sort of mechanisms. But that's a very chip-specific, vendor-specific thing. And the point of the JTAGulator is to just find the pinout, find the right interfaces. So there's 24 connections on the JTAGulator, and you connect up to 24 connections onto a target circuit board, whether they're test points or vias, which are connections between different layers of the board, or, you know, an unpopulated connector, like I mentioned. And you just arbitrarily hook up these up to 24 connections. You don't care of the order, because the JTAGulator will figure out the order for you. And that's the real time-consuming thing, because the number of permutations, like JTAG, you have a minimum of 4 connections that you need. And say you have 8 lines, then you have, I can't do the math in my head, but it's quite a few permutations that you'd have to manually go through to figure out. So this will just, you know, big time saver.
So how long did it take you to build this from, like, you know, kind of spark of the idea to finally getting, you know, working version of it?
It was January, February, March. It was like 3 months of not full time. And it started,
yeah.
It was something, so when I realized I wanted to do it, I was like, okay, this, you know, I haven't kind of done any public security stuff in a while. I want to do this tool and I want to release it publicly. I want it to be open source. I want it to be very easy for people to use, hackable, hand solderable if somebody wanted to build their own. So I sort of came up with these ideas, and I think it was in January I had talked to some guys at Black Hat, and they have a Black Hat track at Design West, which used to be called the Embedded Systems Conference. So it's basically an engineering, electrical engineering conference that now there's like a one track of security.
Okay.
And one of the guys at Black Hat was like, yeah, can you have this work done by then, by April? I'm like, sure. So that was sort of my hard deadline of at least getting the first iteration of this done. And it wasn't totally full time, but it was a lot of work.
Yeah, it sounds like it. I mean, along with other projects and, you know, family and everything else.
Yeah.
You know, what's interesting is, like, a lot of the guys that I talk to, a lot of security researchers and just other folks in the community, like, a lot of them got their start doing that kind of, like, just messing around kind of hardware hacking. I want to break this, see how it works, you know, tear it apart, see what everything does kind of stuff. And then they moved on to other things. And it doesn't seem like it, you know, there was not a ton of that stuff going on for a long time.
Right.
I felt like you and only a couple of other guys were doing it. But now it seems like there seems to be a little bit of a renaissance with it, you know, with the car hacking stuff and some of the, like, smart home type stuff.
Yeah.
We see
medical device stuff.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah,
which is kind of cool.
Yeah, there's been a huge, I don't know if I would call it a resurgence or a renaissance, but it's something, it's now becoming a viable option for lots of people. Doing hardware hacking nowadays, because so many systems are really just, you know, most embedded systems are like a general purpose microcontroller running some sort of code, just like a
yeah.
PC. So all these software guys can, you know, once they get access to firmware, it's a very low, small learning curve to move from, I think, from a, you know, embedded PC to an embedded, standalone embedded system. So now software guys can use their traditional reverse engineering techniques, you know, look for some of the, you know, buffer overflows and interfaces and everything else. So it's definitely something now where I think the tools are available and the equipment's available for cheap and the knowledge is out there, where there's a lot more people saying, oh yeah, hardware is totally wide open. And maybe it's, and I've been waving my hands about it since the days of the loft, because I've always been
right.
a hardware guy in sort of this network-centric world, kind of software application-centric world. And I don't know if it's because, I shouldn't say that software security is getting better, but maybe it's because so many people are now doing software security. I mean, like, you know, a ridiculous amount of people, where a lot
yeah.
of guys might say, okay, well, now I'm going to, you know, tinker a little bit more with electronics, and there's lots of tools available for me to start doing that. And then they realize that they can apply their same skills. Because really, once you know, reverse engineering and once you know attacking products, it's not that much different whether you're doing it on software, on network, on hardware. It's the same mindset. It's just slightly different tools. And once you know how to use those tools, you can pretty much do the same types of stuff. You know, yes, there's specific skills that you need. Like Charlie had tried to take off some of the chips off of his board by himself, and I just kind of pointed at him and laughed at him, which I'm allowed to do, right? Because I'm a hardware guy. But he would also
yeah.
point and laugh at me if I tried to, like, reverse engineer some binary. So
right.
it's also come to the point of you can sort of outsource stuff to different people, right? It's like
yeah.
you know, Charlie knows that he could eventually extract firmware if he wanted to spend the time to fully go through it, or he could send it to me. I can do it, and he can do what he does best. Just like
right,
with
right.
you know, work the parking meter work that I did with Chris Tarnowski, he is, I think, the world's best chip hacker. And it's like, okay, well, I'm not going to learn all the chip decapping techniques and have chemicals in my house when I can just have Chris do it, right? And so
yeah,
it's sort of like
we can all
share our different skills. And yeah, I mean, the whole security industry now is changing. Like, if you look at Black Hat, And even DEF CON presentations this year, there was like a huge amount of embedded system, hardware hacking stuff. And they were all talks were not from people who are traditionally, I would say, electrical engineers or hardware hackers, right? They're mostly from the software
yep.
space moving into this world. which is great. I mean, it took too long, but it's starting to happen. And with, you know, I think Weld had posted on Twitter recently, you know, the Internet of Things is turning into like hack all the things.
Uh-huh.
Because yeah. That's what it is people are starting to implement all sorts of hardware products that are connected to the network and have no idea about security and just assume that because they're hardware products, they're not thinking about anything. And now it's a hardware product that's on the network, so you can do network attacks on it. It's just a totally, like, things are just coming together into this massive explosion of, you know, really bad security
yes.
that we can all take advantage of.
Of badness, yeah. Well, that's the thing. Like, every picture I ever saw of, you know, the loft, there was just piles of electronics gear everywhere.
Yeah.
Like, you know, not just PCs, but like oscilloscopes and just like all kinds of random unidentifiable electronics gear that you guys just piled up and messed with.
Right.
And just sort of figured out how things worked.
Yeah. And that's, I mean, you know, for us, it was all about tinkering and learning and not really having an end goal for the most part. Like Brian Oblivion was really into wireless stuff and into satellite communication. So he had all sorts of satellite gear and spectrum analyzers and oscilloscopes, like into RF stuff way before software-defined radio, way before a lot of these tools were existing. And, mm-hmm. you know, he was into it purely for learning and wanted to set up his own, what he called GorillaNet, sort of a separate, you know, subnet of just all wireless, sort of like, you know, just sort of a subculture wireless network off of the main grid.
And, oh, God.
And he just did it. Like, he was learning all of this stuff, and now he's, you know, really well-versed in that side of things. So we'd always just, it was all about learning and tinkering. And then eventually some of that stuff can be used for, you know, for better design and also for better attack.
Right. Yeah. So what's next for you? What's the next project on the horizon?
I'm scheduled to give a talk at DerbyCon, about the JTAGulator, which is at the end of September. What I would like to do, if not by DerbyCon, but at some point, I'd like to add more support for other types of on-chip debug interfaces, you know, maybe for ARM and for Texas Instruments and for Microchip, just to kind of have this complete platform, because it is open source, and the way that the tool works is you just plug it into the USB port. It'll show up as a virtual COM port. I use an FTDI USB to serial adapter, so you can interface with it for any computer that supports a virtual COM port, so whether it's Linux or PC or whatever you want, you know, Windows. And you can control it through terminal program or PicoCom or screen or, you know, whatever you want to do. So it's a really easy interface. You can program the propeller microcontroller that's on there with some free development tools. So I want to try to continue working on that. And now that it's out there, I think, you know, there'll be some maintenance kind of work with it. But other security stuff, I'm not really sure. And that's kind of how it goes. It's like I'll come out with something and then it's out there. And actually, this is the JTAGulator is being manufactured and sold by Parallax, who has made a bunch of my other kind of hobbyist related stuff. And they're not traditionally in the hacker community, but they realize like this is a really cool tool, and it uses their propeller chip, which they designed, and it sort of gives them a little bit of exposure into the hacking community. And some of their guys had been going to DEF CON for a little while, and it's just I have a great relationship with them. So they're handling all of that for me, so I don't have to do it. Right now I can go back and work on other stuff. But usually it's like, I don't know, I might disappear for a while and work on some consumer stuff or, like, you know, teach some classes or sell stuff on eBay or I don't know. And then something, you know, maybe I'll come up with something else and it will, and you know, give a talk on it. Oh, except I should actually mention that this is, I had just gotten a Cyber Fast Track project approved. Like right before the CFT process ended.
Oh, that must be the last one or pretty close
to
it.
Yeah, it was one of the last ones that they granted. Because I was going to submit something like towards the end of August when the program was supposed to end. And then Mudge said, no, program ends in April. And I think everybody scrambled and they're like, oh, crap. So I was one of the last people to submit and got a project approved for a bunch of circuit board reverse engineering work. So that's actually, that is some security stuff I'm doing.
Nice.
That should end probably in the next few months. I'll be done, and I don't know where I'm going to present it first, but eventually I'll be making the rounds with it and sharing all the information and talking about that. I sort of have this master plan of what I want to do with that work, but that will be really fun to sort of, I mean, to get paid to tear apart circuit boards is kind of cool because I would probably have done it anyway.
Right.
So now it's like, now I can justify it. Like I can go buy cool chemicals to, you know, remove solder mask from boards and all these things that I guess I could have done, but now it just makes it more fun.
So when your wife goes out to the garage and sees you just ripping apart circuit boards, you could be like, no, it's cool.
Yeah,
I'm getting paid.
It's cool. It's research, government research.
It's work.
But yeah, it's actually funny because I have these boxes of different solvents for stripping off solder mask, which is like a kind of tough epoxy coating on boards for one phase of the project. And I want to do this work and I want to videotape it and kind of see how well the materials work. But I can't do it right now because my kids are home.
And yeah, you don't want that.
Because it's summer vacation. So I can't do the work until they go back to preschool.
Right.
Or at least until the older one goes back to preschool and the younger one's like taking a nap or something. And then I'll go outside and like, you know, do it all while they're not around. But yeah, totally just dangerous and probably stuff I shouldn't be doing out of the house. But I don't exactly know, you know, it's for DARPA. It should be fine.
Right, yeah. Either that or they're going to think you have a meth lab in your house.
That's the thing. It's like, I'm sure I'm on a list for the stuff that's coming. Like I ordered beakers and a hot plate and like, yeah, I'm sure I'm on a list. And you know.
Yeah, that's like the Breaking Bad starter kit right there.
Yeah. But it's funny, if I get a knock on the door, it's like, hey, man, I'm doing DARPA research.
Right, I've got to get out of jail free card.
Sure you are. Right. Where's your scale and where's everything else?
What's this DARPA thing you're talking about? Yeah.
Yeah.
Sure.
But yeah, so, you know, there's always something new that I'm working on. I just don't exactly know when things will, you know, ever kind of make it out there.
Right. All right. Well, we'll look out for all that stuff. And it was good catching up, Joe. Thanks a lot,
yeah,
man.
Yeah.
We should do it more than once every like 3 years.
Yeah. No, I'd be happy to. I appreciate the opportunity. And of course, if people have, you know, questions, they can always email me directly or go to my website, which is grandideastudio.com and go to the contact page and get in touch with me. And yeah, I'd love to, you know, chat about everything and of course stay in touch with you and do more of these.
All right, you got it. Thanks a lot, Joe.
Cool.
Great talking to you.
See ya.
See you, man.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. Compliments Kaspersky Lab, a world leader in internet threat protection for small, medium, and large enterprises. Visit Kaspersky.com for more information about their line of premium protection solutions.